Hello, hello, and welcome to Art Pop Talk. I'm Gianna.
And I'm Bianca. Gianna, what is our episode about today?
You know, I think it's something like, well, come to think of it, what are we talking about today?
So I think the topic is, well, undecided. We have a couple little topics today that we are going to think through in a workshop live on air, but we are going to be generally thinking about the music and aesthetic of the early 2000s, but our thought process on this topic will be funky fresh. So Gianna, you want to try to make this work?
I do indeed. Let's Art Pop Talk.
All right, Gianna, how's it going?
It's going. You know, I hope the rest of the world is having a lovely three-day weekend, which it was nice. I got to take some time to get some things done, but it's been a very productive, kind of long, exhausting weekend.
Well, hopefully it's nice to have that extra day.
Oh yeah, it is for sure. I mean, I feel like maybe it's, I don't know, gotten my butt in gear to get things done, to take advantage of it. I kind of have a little wedding update.
Okay.
It's not very exciting.
I still want to know what it is.
So, I don't know. Maybe the Art Pop Tarts can help a sister out, or this is an example of me just needing my feelings validated. So, that's going to happen once in a while.
We can definitely make that happen.
Okay, good. Yeah, that's why I started this podcast, just to validate myself.
I hear you 1,000%.
So Theban and I went to go look at our first venue for the wedding, and you know, it was really fun and exciting, but this time of season is bridal expo prime,
yeah,
as I'm learning and finding out that I walked into. So this venue was having like an open house, right? I've been wanting to see this venue for a while, so I thought, okay, great, they're having an open house. You know, as soon as I walked in, I was bombarded by like three people who were like, hi, are you the bride? Hi, are you the bride? Hi, are you the bride? Yeah. I was like, oh, Jesus Christ. Like,
yep.
And I was with Theban. We're both here looking at this venue, and he is a hard presence to ignore. He is,
yes,
very tall, like takes up the space.
Handsome,
like
some man.
Yeah, like excellent to look at. Smoke show of a fiance. We are just
hard to miss.
We are just large people. Like, we're hard to ignore. And
yeah.
This was the first time in my life I've seen that happen. You know, so everyone's like, hi, are you the bride? Hi, are you the bride? Mm-hmm. Like, Theban is just like a ghost. And,
right,
you know, oh, okay, brides, put their emails down over here. And I'm like trying to talk. And I don't even know what I wrote down on this piece of paper. It wasn't my email. I think I wrote like Gianna Fink with like
bride.
And then it was
bride
like,
at gmail.com.
Bride at gmail.com. And then they asked what my wedding date was. And I'm like, I don't have,
bitch, I'm here to look at your venue.
A fucking wedding date. I'm here to look at this venue. And then I got really overwhelmed because I was looking at all the other fucking brides on this list, and they all put their date down. Am I supposed to have my date picked out and then look at a venue?
Right.
So this was just weird. And so like the venue was very pretty, blah, 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 got a price breakdown. And it wasn't until we started getting into more like conversations about the logistics of the venue to where the person giving us like a tour really like acknowledge Theban's presence.
Yeah.
And I guess here's my thing. I don't know if I shared the extent of the story of picking out my engagement ring and how it was just a very gendered process, and I worked with this shitty sales rep who was just basically trying to make assumptions about my career and the different salaries between myself and my male fiance.
Yeah.
And it was just horrible. And I think it's also really funny now what I'm experiencing is because Theban and I designed and picked out my engagement ring like together, and we both contributed financially to my engagement ring because that's a lot of money, and I also like I want what I want. And so another funny part that I'm dealing with is when I show people my ring and they're like, oh, he did such a good job, and I'm like, what are you fucking talking about? Like, I am the one who basically designed what I wanted. And so with The Ring, I was used to all this attention being on, like, the male part of this shit show of this dance, I suppose. And now dealing with the venue, I don't know. It's just wild. And I'm like, all the attention is now on me. I am the target. I'm feeling extremely targeted. And because I think it's because I have been following some venues in the area that I liked, I am having these like florists and bakeries who do wedding cakes follow me on Instagram now. And it's giving me kind of a heart attack. Like, I feel like I'm being targeted so much. And there was a different bridal expo in Tulsa the same weekend we went to go see this venue. And we just decided not to go for a number of reasons. Like, cases are really bad right now. But also, we were just kind of recovering from this teeny tiny venue experience, and it was all catered towards the bride. And I'm like, why would I take Theban to not a wedding expo, a bridal expo, when no one is going to give him the actual time of day? I don't want to normalize any of this, but like, is this quote unquote normal, or have other people experienced this in this whole shindig?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure that a lot of the listeners will have some very interesting stories to share with us about this. So we should definitely do like a poll on our Instagram or send in some emails if you have a good story about this. I think that when I worked as a wedding planner, this was a lot of what I just observed. And when I worked for the wedding planner, I would go to some of those expos, either in support of some of my colleagues in the area, or I would be working the event. And one time I literally walked in, and our own Adrian Turner, like sister of APT, I walked in, and she just like in the kind of like, you know, fuzz of like all of these people coming in and out of the event, I walked in and she looked at me and was like, "Hi, are you the bride?"
Oh, you've never told me.
And
this.
I was like, "Adrian," like, and she was like, "Oh my God, hi." Like, it's just like, it's just a strange reaction. I will say that sometimes when women go in with their friends, you know, that's kind of a normal question to be like, "Hi, are you the bride?" Just given if you are going in with some of your bridesmaids or friends like that, like if you're in a group of other women. But it is completely horrendous to me to ignore the groom. And I just think that's really gross.
Again, like,
and it's just, it shouldn't be an all-encompassing thing. Everyone is going to treat their own wedding differently. And sometimes if the groom isn't involved, that's totally fine. If you know, a bride doesn't want their groom involved, or that's just not how their flow is, like, that's completely fine. But it's the assumption that Theban has nothing to do with the wedding planning that makes me really upset.
Yeah, it's just weird. And again, this was not a bridal expo. This was an open house for a venue. And they could say like, "Hi," like, there are so many other ways to like greet people to like not make too many assumptions. And then this is also the last weird thing about this venue that I'll bring up is they were like, "Oh, have you booked a date with us?" And I was like, "No, that's why I'm here, to see the venue." And then it got me thinking, are other people, did they book this venue and now are they coming to this open house? Like, it's just not necessary. Like, there's like one photographer booth, one DJ, and like a couple, you know, bakeries that do wedding cakes. And I'm like, why would you do a tour of this venue, book, and then come to this weird open house? Like, I'm not trying to tell you how to do your job, but like, this is weird.
Right. It does seem, that seems very, very strange. And a lot of those types of expos do have really great vendor deals, and it's a great way for vendors to get their name out there. So I can understand people who haven't booked a lot of their vendors for the day wanting to do that and like go meet new vendors in person. But also, that's not the only reason that someone might be entering this space.
I don't know. It was weird. And then I really like this venue because it was like beautiful and it was small. Like, a lot of these like huge venues that are really pretty, they're too big for what I need. And the bummer was, this was kind of like me and Theban were like, "What? Like, this is, I don't know." Because the like bridal suite, both are very small, but the bridal suite is a lot bigger. You know, it has a whole like vanity section to like get ready.
Right.
And like the bathroom has a shower in it. The quote-unquote groom's room it's like a closet. I mean, it was so small, and there were like four chairs or three chairs like in each corner of the room. And I'm like, what are they supposed to do? Only one person can get ready in here. But are the like groomsmen and Theban just supposed to sit in these chairs and stare at each other for an hour?
Gianna, this is reminding me of our bathrooms or bath rudes episode.
Like, yes.
The dynamic between a bathroom and yes, groom rude. It was just
like gender at its finest.
No, that is exactly what I've experienced at every other venue that I've worked at as well, is the gender dynamics between the bridal suite and the groom's room, even if the groom's room is bigger and more put together than what you're kind of describing in this one here.
The aesthetics are like very different.
The aesthetics are a 180. It is literally like the bathroom situation that we talked about in that episode. The bridal suite is like lacy and beautiful and pristine, which, like, don't get me wrong, I enjoy, given that I would like to, you know, get ready. There's a lot of getting ready activities happening in that room. But what pisses me off to no end is when I go into a groom's room and they have like a fucking pool table and a nice ass bar.
Oh, it's always
and
like a
video
games table
and sports on and like, you know, guns and hunting weapons and all this stuff. I'm just like, Can you not? Like, what if we wanted a fucking TV in our room? Like, half of my girlfriends would probably want to play fucking Mario Kart or something
no,
while we're getting ready. Like, it just makes
me
so mad.
Because the last wedding that I was in September, it was at a venue in Stillwater, and it was the same thing. You know, this is a venue specifically designed for weddings, and the suites are exactly the same size, but the aesthetics are very different. And the bridal suite didn't even have a goddamn TV in it, whereas they had like an Xbox and a foosball table.
Yep.
And I was like, yo, like, who wants to go over and play foosball? Like, we're just sitting here like staring at each other.
Yeah, what are we doing? Just twiddling our thumbs when the guys are like having fun and playing games
no,
and stuff?
It's,
like, I
it's
just
so
don't understand.
Rude. And I'm like, what?
It is.
I don't know. It just... It was really frustrating. And again, we are talking about large human beings here, right? Like,
yes.
I'm not a tiny woman. Theban is not a tiny person. Like, Theban cannot share that space with another person. No one will fit in there. Even like, you know what I mean?
So, Gianna, what I'm hearing from you is that we are going to go full on, like, wedding episodes. Definitely not during the time, like, around when your wedding would happen. But when you're a little bit further along in the wedding process and you're talking to vendors and all this stuff, we have got to do a full-on bride room or bride rude episode.
Yes, yes, yeah. I can have you hold up scorecards after the story. Like, was that groom rude?
Oh, yes.
Or, yeah, yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
I love it.
Well,
I'm sorry that weddings are gendered and it's dumb. It's, like, so stupid. You should just be able to celebrate with the ones that you love. And it shouldn't be about Theban and his groomsmen, like, playing foosball and you staring at yourself in front of a mirror.
Honestly, at this point, I wish there was room in the getting ready space for the guys for there to be a fucking foosball table in there. But no. Like... I don't even know, man.
It's so funny.
So we'll have to pin that.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's actually a really fun episode idea. I love that.
Yeah.
If it's not going to cause you too much stress.
No, I just created this platform to vent and validate on. So
yeah, if you have any tips or suggestions, or if you want to share your own wedding day planning stories with us, email us at ourpuptalk@gmail.com because oh my gosh,
that'd be fantastic.
We'd love to hear. Would love to hear. Believe me. Oh my goodness. Well, Gianna, you want to take us through a few little art news stories before we get into our wishy-washy episode?
Of course. So for art news today. We actually have a couple of stories for you. So first off, 2022 is off to an interesting start because Wikipedia editors have voted not to classify NFTs as art. My understanding is that the question if NFTs are art or not started because they were putting together a list of highest art sales by living artists, and two of them recently and technically came through NFT sales for artists Beeple and Parks. 5 out of the 6 editors voted against NFTs, and here are the reasons why. Quote, Wikipedia really can't be in the business of deciding what counts as art or not, which is why putting NFTs as art or not in their own list makes things a lot simpler. This caused some debate, mostly in terms of artistic production for digital artists in particular. I couldn't help but think about last episode's conversation on image rights. I know, you know, there's a lot more to get into here about the possibilities that NFTs can provide for artists and just a lot more room for exploration and sales. And I want to hear your thoughts on that, Bianca, but I can't help fixating on how NFTs could and probably are helping with image right issues in the digital age.
Yeah, so part of me, when I read that quote, Wikipedia can't really be in the business of deciding what counts as art or not, that kind of makes sense because I do think that NFTs, strictly speaking, NFTs are very broad. Like NFTs don't necessarily have to be made by a digital artist, but it could just be, like you're saying, a digital image or video of some sorts. Like, you know, there are sports clips that are now NFTs. Like you can buy the rights to a very exciting score made by a basketball player or whatever, and that counts as an NFT. So I understand their thinking in not 1000% saying these are works of art, but that doesn't mean that they're not works of art. So to a certain extent, I understand. I think that artists, though, like digital artists working in NFTs, do have a right to call them out on this, saying that I am making art through this type of visual medium. But so I understand the gray area. I just think it's a little bit weird that they have to qualify it as a yes or no answer when it's both, I suppose.
Yeah, I agree. I was thinking that some of the backlash against it was like a little bit dramatic. Like people Agreed. Were saying like, the art world is gonna unravel, like we rely on this. And I was like, whoa, let's calm down. It's okay. I understand what you're saying, but this totally. Is a very new and broad realm to get into that houses a multitude of different things, as you just said.
Right.
So it's kind of like art is a big gray area, guys. Like this is not new. It's not that it isn't completely 100% not,
yeah.
But it is used. It's just not that one thing.
I think the biggest point of concern for me is what we've been talking about, where creative people, and we talk about this in our STEAM and STEM episode with Adrian Turner, creative people are responsible for so much of our daily occurrences. So I think that's the biggest part, where creative people in general deserve to be paid and recognized for the work that they put into whatever it is, even if it's marketing, if it's things on Instagram, if it's web design. An NFT, say it's a video of a basketball player making a score, that takes video production work that is a creative outlet and deserves respect no matter what. And I think that for me is the bottom line of this issue. We should definitely keep advocating for this, but on the basis level of what is art, of course, nobody's ever going to answer that question. Wikipedia doesn't have to, because we all know the answer to that. Everything is. So
yeah, for sure. So, you know, 2022 is getting a little spicy, so I thought I'd share that. So for another short and important art news story, I wanted to mention that a bill authored by Representative Grace Meng would establish a commission to study the possibilities of a National Museum of Asian Pacific American History and Culture, and it would also provide Congress with a strategy for building and maintaining the museum, a fundraising plan, and a potential location. So how did this idea for creating this museum come about? So a source from The Hill gave us some great quotes from Meng saying, I just thought that we should, as the fastest growing community in the country, also have a museum that's dedicated to our history and culture. I really felt even more strongly about this during the last year and a half, where so many people in our community have been discriminated against or attacked, and thought that it's really important that in our nation's capital, we have something dedicated to helping more people learn about our history and culture. I have felt for too long that when people see Asian Americans, they do not truly view us as Americans. They view us as perpetual foreigners. This was actually a source that Bianca had shared with me earlier this week. We had a lot going on for art news, but really fascinating. I mean, this is still very much in the kind of workshop stages, but I think we can definitely say that we're absolutely here for it. I think in other museums, recognizing also African-American and Black history, that was a huge part of this idea and this museum and coming to the forefront too. You know, if we have this kind of representation, we also need this as well.
Yeah, no, like literally nothing else to say besides I will advocate for this museum 1000%. So
yeah,
that's all that I have to say about
that.
Yes, 1,000,000%. Yes.
Yes.
Let's do it.
So it's interesting. There is like a subcommittee of this legislation that's happening right now, and Grace is kind of spearheading this project. So lots of things going on. We'll keep you guys posted if there's any updates, but super exciting.
I love it.
Yeah. Okay, so enough is enough. You guys are probably wondering what is going on with today's episode. I almost feel like it's crystal clear to me now, but it wasn't so crystal clear this entire week when Bianca and I were just workshopping what to freaking do. So basically earlier last week, I guess at this point, Bianca had sent me a Spotify curated playlist called Y2K, and it just unlocked so many memories musically and visually for Bianca and me. But we also spent the day workshopping and just trying to remember like where these songs came from. Like there's something really specific about this song and like the moment I heard it or where I was. And since Bianca and I are basically the same person, like our obscure like references are just one and the same and linked. So anyways, it just was something so specific and minute to our childhood, but we're going to share it with you today. And you're going to get from it. You're just along for the ride.
Because let me tell you guys, I could not think of another topic to cover this week because I was so concerned about figuring out where I knew these songs from. And I just spent a day and it was just, I couldn't get it out of my head. There was this song, which I will play for you and we'll talk about here in a minute. It got me so stuck. I mean, I literally talked to Gianna and I was like, I cannot think of one possible topic that I want to cover for Art Pop Talk because first I have to unlock the mystery of why I know every single word to this song. It just...
You sent it to
me. It had to be done.
While I was at work, you sent me the song. And as soon as I heard it.
And you knew it too.
I was like smiling and I was like so happy. And I was like, oh my God, I love this song. And then after I finished, I was like, wait, what the fuck is this song? I don't know it. And yet I know it.
Oh my gosh.
What is it from? And like.
Right.
Oh my God.
And the visuals, they were just there. They were in my head. But I couldn't. I knew that they were there somewhere, and we're going to talk about how they became unlocked and why these strange visuals are connected to these memories of sound and music. So before we get into the song that led us to where we are now, Gianna, I thought we would play a little game if you're up for it. And I want to play some songs for you and our listeners that were on this playlist. Some are on the Y2K playlist and some are from a different playlist that Audrey Kaminsky had put together. It's pretty fantastic as well, but it also recalled some straight up hardcore 2000s visuals. So I'm just going to play a plethora of songs and you are going to tell me what it visually recalls for you, whether that be a movie, a music video, an experience you had of the song. I just want you to describe it for me. Tell me what you instantly think of visually whenever you hear this song.
Okay, so I don't know song, okay? I don't know how, no, so I don't have to know the title of the song. I just have to recall the memory.
You just have to recall the memory for me. Because let me tell you, when I was like having my showers this week, I was full on like in childhood Bianca's memory, just vibing through some bops here.
Okay. I'm so excited.
Okay. Oh, oh, this one is such a good one. Okay. Tell me what you think. First song.
Okay, so I know that this is Josie and the Pussycats.
Yes.
I know that for a fact. But my memory with it is definitely with a movie. I want to say like...
No, you haven't.
I have like 10 Things I Hate About You or...
Oh, that's kind of a similar aesthetic.
Or... I all the like early 2000s movie, like 10 Things I Hate About You, like Legally Blonde, Sleepover, like all of those.
Yes. So this is from the Josie and the Pussycats movie, Gianna. And I don't know that we ever rented this movie, but it was one of those movies that played on TV all the time. So I knew this song because they would play the Josie and the Pussycats movie on TV. And that's the only time I would listen to this song.
Oh my God. Yeah, you're definitely right.
Yes.
The cover art. Oh my gosh. No, you're right. If we definitely didn't rent it, but if it was on, it was on TV. And I'm sure if I go back and watch it, something very familiar is going to come up.
Oh, yes. Oh, I kind of want to find it. I wonder where I can stream it.
Yeah.
I wonder if our listeners... I'm so excited to see what all the listeners, like, remember about all these songs, too.
Okay. Just because of it being so, like, punk, like, 10 Things I Hate About You. That's what I was thinking.
It's... Yeah. I can totally see that.
Because there is a good song in that one because the band plays on the roof.
Oh, I'm going to find it and I'll play it for you. And you'll know. You'll know. Okay. Okay. Ready?
Stop. I know. It's Legally Blonde. It's Legally Blonde.
On this perfect day. Legally Blonde. What do you picture? I picture her like putting on her shoes with the little hearts.
So this is the opening hairbrush. Song where like the credits and we see like her blonde hair. She's like brushing her hair, like doing
and
her
the
nails.
Little perfume.
Yeah, she's like getting ready. And then Warner, thinking he's like, ah, oh, perfect. I'm going to get engaged. And no. He sucks.
No, we hate Warner. Okay, ready?
Bath rude Warner. Oh. This is Princess Diaries.
Yes, Princess Diaries, Gianna. When I heard this song, it's at the end scene. It is the very end of Princess Diaries. And they're at the ball and she, you know, says she's going to be, you know, Princess of Genovia. And they play this song at the very end of the movie. And when I heard it, I physically had to watch the Princess Diaries because I listened to the song and I was like, there is no way I can go about my day without watching this movie now.
Yeah. I wonder if it was on... The reason why I might know that one, too, is I had a Princess Diaries CD. I think it was for the first one, but I remember there being, like, a Fergie song on there. But was it the...
I can picture the CD cover, too, that we had.
Was it Princess Diaries 1 or 2? Because there is a song on this playlist. Kelly Clarkson wrote a song for Princess Diaries.
Oh, I feel like that's the second one, I want to say.
Okay. I can't think
but
of
we'll
that.
Look it up.
It might come up.
You're going to know this one, but I want our listeners to hear it anyway.
I mean, come on. Freaky Friday, Get Out. Okay, but can I tell you why I know this one? It is because her and her, like, cute little, like, bandmates were wearing, like, the slip, like, quintessential dress, like, 90s, 2000s, like, slip dress. And she was wearing, like, a purple lacy one. And she was barefoot. And then, like, the edgy girl with, like, the black hair who's, like, goth was wearing, like, her little, like, black slip. Who I thought was, like, I was like, oh, yeah, that one's goth. So good. No, their outfits were just, like, amazing. I just thought Lindsay Lohan was, like, the coolest.
No, truly.
We could still all do a lot worse than Lindsay Lohan. Like,
oh, 1,000,000,000. Oh, I have the Kelly Clarkson song. Oh, well, but I'm gonna play it for you, and you tell me if you remember.
Okay. Yes, Breakaway.
Yes, once you hear it. This is the Princess Diaries 2 Royal Engagement on the soundtrack. And so that whenever I hear that song, I can see that cover now that you bring it up.
Yeah. Talk about also transformation. Like Kelly Clarkson, I feel like the branding of her after American Idol days was so quintessential early 2000s. And now she's just like her own woman. And I love to see it. This one's gonna make me cry.
I'm thinking about your wedding now.
So, I did recently just add this song to the Wedding Hot Jams playlist. So, this is, of course, from Parent Trap, another exquisite Lindsay Lohan production.
Oh my God, truly. Truly.
There are so many other songs from that movie that I remember, like There She Goes. That's such a good one. Princess Diaries as well. It's in the first one, I think. She's getting ready for the day, and she's riding on her scooter, and she's going to school. This is definitely in Princess Diaries.
Not Princess Diaries. I'm looking at the Princess Diaries soundtrack just to see. No, I don't see it, Gianna. Maybe it is.
I feel it so strongly.
Okay, can I tell you?
Yes.
It's from Legally Blonde whenever she is like on the treadmill and she has her orange MacBook that she just bought from the store.
Damn
it. She's like working out. And it's the moment where she's like, you know what? I'm about to fuck Werner up. When I hear that, I picture her on the treadmill with her orange MacBook.
I was picturing it like it was some kind of sequence of like getting ready or like, you know,
it was. I can see that.
Damn it.
Okay, ready?
Oh, of course, it's Lizzie McGuire. The movie.
Lizzie McGuire movie. Yay. At the beginning where she also has a getting ready sequence.
Which makes sense because if the songs are like memorable, it's because, you know, scenes are happening in the background and we're like, you know, we're listening to the song. So that makes sense.
Right. Okay. I feel like I want to do one more, Gianna. Is that okay?
Okay. Yeah. Do one more.
Okay. Ready?
Yeah, I'm ready. Okay, this is in Confessions of a Teenage Drama Queen when her and Megan Fox are like racing each other to get to see the set list.
Oh my God.
And like Megan Fox is wearing like a denim like one piece situation, and Lindsay Lohan is wearing like a cute little hat and like a bunch of like buttons or something.
It, the song is called Nana.
That one is
from
like
Confessions of a
Teenage brutal because they're like, like I guess they're knocking like each other over in
the school. So wow, that was such a funny game. I just want to keep playing this game for the rest of the episode.
There was like a pair of sunglasses, like a trend that I really wanted to get because of Confessions of a Teenage Drama Queen, and it was when like she's in the mall and they're trying to get tickets to Sid Arthur. You know, they're like workshopping, and she's wearing the blue glasses without frames, and I was like,
yes, and she's like her Knicks outfit on. It's like the New York Knicks.
Let me tell you, blue sunglasses without frames was the look.
Truly. Okay, so oh my God, that was so fun. I just
I love that.
I love thinking about all these visuals that I just associate every single one of these with. So here's the real winner, Gianna, and this is the song That's What Girls Do by No Secrets from 2002. And this song is the one that sent me into a deep black hole that I could not get out of. So I'm just gonna play like a little sneak peek. Okay.
This was the song that unlocked it all.
This was the song. And I don't know if you guys are listening to the song and you have the same reaction. But I heard it come up on the Y2K playlist. And I was trying so hard to remember why I know every single word of that song. And unlike our game here, the visuals I was trying to remember were coming from a material object that I had as a kid, not necessarily as an active experience like watching a film or remembering a scene from a movie or a music video or anything like that. When I was trying to figure out where this came from, I was scouring the internet, like That's What Girls Do, No Secrets, where is this from? And I went to go watch their music video on YouTube and I was like, maybe that's what it is. Also, this music video is wild.
Something else.
It is wow.
The quality.
Oh boy. So I'm looking through the comments of the YouTube video and then, okay, they did, someone was commenting that they had that song on a hit clip. And at first I was like, oh my gosh, that must be what it is. I must have had a hit clip of this. But that's not what it was because it kept nagging at me. I was like, you know what? I just don't think that's right. I know I had
because
an Oops, I Did It Again.
I was
going to
say,
clip.
The only one we had was like, no, Britney Spears. And there was one with like NSYNC or something.
I feel like we had, yeah, like a Backstreet Boys one or something, or NSYNC, one of those.
But that was
it. But we only had like, yeah, a few hit clips. And I was like, you know what? I just don't think that's what it is. So I keep looking. Sure enough, there's a comment. Let me just read the comment in full because it truly unleashed a fucking miracle upon my brain cells. So, Radio Disney CD from McDonald's. And when I read that, I thought, holy shit, that is exactly what I needed. And sure enough, this song was on a four-track CD that we got from a Mighty Kids meal at McDonald's that had Baja Men, Jump 5, No Secrets, and Six Piece. I looked on the internet to try to find the Mighty Kids, what is it called? Radio Disney Mighty Music CD. And you could get these as like in place of a toy at McDonald's for the Mighty Kids meal, which was like a step up from the Happy Meal. And I don't know if we had any more of these CDs, but we had this one. And when I saw the cover of the CD, just go look at it on our Instagram or our resources page. Like, this sent me back. This is exactly, it put me literally at such ease to know that this is the source of that knowledge in my brain that has just lived in my brain for 26 years.
It was wild. We could not put our finger on it, and Bianca truly found it. And as soon as she sent me like the image of this Mighty Kids meal CD, I gasped. I remember it as clear as day. But truly. You're right. I do not remember owning literally any other Mighty Kids meal CDs. So the fact that like this is like the one that popped up too was excellent. But there was one other song on that same CD, which...
Should I play it?
Yeah, I think you should.
If anyone else had the CD, maybe this is the song that will send you back.
So we need everyone to know that that is also on the Wedding Hot Jams playlist.
Oh, I told Gianna, I think that all of the bridal party should walk out to one of these songs from the Mighty Kids Meal CD.
The funny thing about this song was I was like, I was like, you know, what's the name of the band? Like, it's Baja Men. And like, they're pretty well known more than like No Secrets. Like,
right,
you know,
right.
They're like a little bit more well known. But I wasn't thinking so much about the band. I was thinking more of like, again, what we just did. Like, where is this from? There's some very specific memory with this. And yes. There was something earlier when we were trying to figure out No Secrets. I don't know. Somehow Shrek came up.
Because Shrek also has an iconic
playlist.
List of songs.
Shrek has
truly
fucking amazing soundtrack.
But there is, I think it's on the first Shrek DVD. Gianna and I would always watch the special features, and there was this music video by the Baja Men for their song Best Years of Our Lives on the Shrek special features DVD. So that's this song.
Jenna
and I started thinking about the Baja Men, and then we were like, wait, is that the song that was on the Mighty Kids Meal CD? But no, Baja Men, you know, we're on our Mighty Kids Meal and on our Shrek DVD special features.
I mean, that is just a bop if I have ever heard one in my life.
God, I cannot wait. I truly cannot wait for your wedding, Gianna, because I just don't know if I'm going to go out to a different location that will play that song. And I cannot wait.
It's just going to be like a
wedding.
Very weird mix of like Malay pop music in early 2000s and like maybe some like Kali and Bollywood. Like, it's going to be like an interesting mix. But yeah, so the playlist is a little all over the place. I'm so here for it. Jams only. I'm being very selective about it.
So before we move on to just a little brief synopsis about some memory association, some artists that might take us back a little bit, I just had one fact that I needed every single one of you listening to know. Whenever I was in the YouTube comments for the No Secrets music video, I found out that Lady Gaga was supposed to be in No Secrets, was supposed to be a member of No Secrets whenever she was 16 or so. And I do have an article from, I think, Pop Crush that is linked in our resources where you can like read more about this situation. But she was originally supposed to be in No Secrets. And I just...
It's just the best news I've
There's probably heard. A reason that that called to me. And it's because of its association to Lady Gaga. So, Gianna, do you have any other thoughts before we get a little bit more information about this phenomenon?
Yes. I just need you guys to know, and maybe if you don't already feel this way, if any of those songs maybe haven't triggered a memory for you yet, maybe one will come up, but I just hope that you feel at peace after this episode. Because in the words of Bianca, after we figured it out, I was on the phone with her and she just goes, "I'm just at peace." And it's just the best thing that's happened in like a while. So my wish for you in 2022 is that you feel at peace after this.
Oh my gosh. Wow. Oh. To talk a little bit more, you know, scientifically about this situation we have going on right here, it might seem very obvious that our senses become related to memory. So according to a BBC article by Tiffany Jenkins, quote, "This is an experience shared by everyone. Hear a piece of music from decades later and you are transported back to that particular moment. Like stepping into a time machine." That is for sure a time machine taking me back to get a Mighty Kids meal. "You can feel everything as if you were actually there. The relationship between music and memory is powerful, and new research is hoping to discover how these memories work for therapeutic effect. It is already used to help dementia patients, the elderly, and for those suffering from depression." Jenkins explains that, quote, "The hippocampus and the frontal cortex are two large areas in the brain associated with memory, and they take in a great deal of information every day. Retrieving it is not always easy. It doesn't simply come back when you ask it to. Music helps because it provides a rhythm and rhyme and sometimes alliteration, which helps to unlock that information with cues. It is the structure of the song that helps us remember it, as well as the melody and the images the words provoke." There are different kinds of memory, including explicit and implicit memory. Explicit memory is a deliberate, conscious retrieval of the past, which is often prompted by questions like, "Where was I when that summer happened? Who was I traveling with?" An implicit memory is more reactive, which is an unintentional form of memory. Robert Snyder, a composer and chair of the sound program at the Art Institute of Chicago, said, quote, "A large part of memory takes place in the unconscious mind. There are aspects of memory that are remembered implicitly, that is, outside of consciousness. Implicit memory systems involve different parts of the brain than explicit memory systems. It is the explicit memory systems that are damaged by conditions such as Alzheimer's disease. The implicit systems are robust in comparison." Snyder explains that, quote, "Things can affect us from outside of consciousness are often regarded as powerful. In other words, implicit memory is emotional as well as durable." So there's this really emotional and long-lasting kind of connection in the components of something that makes up an implicit memory.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting because I know that we're focusing on this Y2K playlist and this era of music, but I can even just think of some really specific albums that I'm super attached to and why or when I was listening to them. Probably like the most recent one that I have like this nostalgic memory of is like traveling in Europe with you, Bianca, and listening to Happiness Begins on like all the trains, planes, and automobiles. That was the summer album. I wanted to get into a little bit of vocab, I suppose. Sound art versus music, since we are getting a little bit more technical into like the art history of it all. And I guess this is maybe a little disclaimer, and I feel like we've come across this with Josh Thoughts or for myself, like when I ask other musicians questions about their knowledge of art history, they use different vocabulary. They're coming from a different perspective. You know, for example, a lot of people who study music theory or musicians, they don't equate these pieces into the Flexus movement. They use other terminology. And I'm sorry I'm a little ignorant to that terminology, but I just want to say that in the sense that this is maybe a little subjective. Also in terms of what is music, because if we've learned anything from Josh's thoughts, technically anything that like is sound is music, but we are going to get into some vocabulary. So
Wikipedia might have something to say about that.
Well, I don't, I can't quite qualify. We can't say what is it or what is it not music. So what am I good for? So sound art often... I guess that's my Wikipedia editor voice. I don't know where that one came from. Okay, so from the help of a Widewall article, let's get into sound art. Sound art often overlaps with experimental music or noise, but there are still important distinctions that make it a separate form of expression. It is distinct by the perceptual, conceptual, and intellectual approaches and issues raised by sound works, and also its ultimate aim. While it is possible to communicate many things through music, the composer fundamentally only communicates the music's form, focused on sound issues and the possibilities to manipulate it in order to restructure it as another outfit. Sound artists raise important questions through their conceptual exploration of the complex relationship between the sound, the listener, and space. They are interested in the way the sound behaves in space or in one's mind and the possibility of forming something sculptural out of invisible waves. The way music and sound art are experienced is also different. While a musical piece should be experienced in its entirety, sound art is usually experienced in a venue where the artist has no control over how much time a listener spends with the piece. Still, there are no boundaries and strict rules, and these two forms can overlap. So thoughts and notions about this terminology, because I do feel like there are contradictions. I think it's different. When we talk about the inception of a piece, and a lot of times in terms of art history, a performance happens and there is an audience there. So in a way, the composer has control over their audience. And also when it comes to music, there is also on the flip side a lot of control that they don't have. Sure, we have a song that's maybe only 3 or 2 minutes long, but we might skip that song on our playlist. So really it's kind of also out of the artist's control. But those are also performance artists as well, people in the pop culture sense. So it definitely is a lot of overlap. Also in terms of like sound art has to have this like deeper meaning or what's its ultimate aim. Like normal contemporary music has that as well. Like there is an idea, there is a goal, whatever that may be, whether you think that's deep or not deep, there is something there. So I think this is just in terms of, are we talking about pop culture music or are we talking about something that can be recognized as a performative piece of art and exist in like an academic or museum space eventually? And does break some norms. Maybe the length of the piece is like 40 minutes long or something like that. So if we look more at the origin of sound art, we can get into some examples. The earliest use of the term is traced back to the exhibition at the Sculpture Center in New York in 1983, but the term became commonplace only in the 1990s. Still, the origin of this artistic form takes us back to the early 20th century and the works of two avant-garde movements. First, we have the Italian futurist, Luigi Russolo, who wrote the manifesto, The Art of Noises, in 1913, in which he propagated the use of industrial and military noises to conceive a new kind of music. He has built noise machines that replicate the clatter of the industrial age and the boom of warfare. And then apart from futurists, we can get into the Dadaists, also contributed greatly to this new kind of artistic expression. Hugo Ball famously performed his sound poetry at Cabaret Voltaire in Zurich. This is where Dada was born in 1916, where his performance was purely a theatrical presentation of sound. saying all these unrecognizable sounds and words in his performance. He had previously studied acting in school, but with this being said, the art came from the sounds and this lack of meaning, not necessarily his acting skills. Ball also wore interesting costumes, but again, this visual aspect was also secondary to the sound. Between 1922 and 1932, Kurt Schwitters did something similar when he created a piece, Ursinate, that was 40 minutes long and consisted of vocal utterance, vowels and consonants, and words with no meaning. We can even tie our beloved John Cage into this loop when silence became a part of sound and performance. So if we look at a more contemporary artist, Arnie Sala, who employs moving installations and their sounds to probe historical ruptures and failures of language. He explores nonverbal modes of expression through narratives or ideas that can be shared through music and pictures. This distance from a logical, direct, language-based understanding opens the door to multiple perspectives and interpretations. The music in his practice speaks to history and memory, and it brings together the past, present, and future of the viewer into a single multi-sensory experience. I think also just to keep in the back of your mind too, we did bring up in our definition of sound art to think about it in terms of a sculptural sense, which I think is really helpful because you're manifesting something that's happening internally, and for the same reasons why performative art is wrapped up in the study of something like sculpture. For Sala, sound has always functioned as both an expressive medium, and a register of memory hauntingly subject to erasure. The artist aims to reverse a historical amnesia through the use of sound, which becomes a means in which he can investigate the relationship between the present, the past, and displacement. And not to be dramatic, but this is a little bit how I felt when trying to figure out the No Secrets song. Where did it come from? I cannot pinpoint a place, which is how I am remembering all these other songs. So it's that sense of displacement. So if we take one of Sala's pieces, for example, done in about 2006, is Air Cushion Ride, which uses this idea of this oral phenomenon that the artist experienced while driving across Arizona as he listened to Baroque chamber music on his car radio on a highway rest area. As he was approaching a group of parked semi-trucks, or lorries, the airwaves of an unknown country music radio station basically interrupted the music that he was listening to. So in this piece, there's a video component, and the video consists of the recording of this experience, illustrating how Sala approaches the notion of place from the point of view of memory and the subjective experience of time and space. Quote, "What I call a place is where one remembers having been, which is not only made up of space, but also time." So the camera in this video pans around the trucks while the two sounds, kind of speakers on either side of this moving picture, alternate according to the position of the car in relation to them. So almost the subtitle to this larger piece, Air Cushion Ride, to this sound component is Spurious Emission. Sala commissioned a composer to transcribe the recording of the conflicting radio waves into a musical score. The video presents the encounter in what seems to be a music rehearsal studio between a trio of kind of like violins, basses, that kind of stuff, versus like a country band with guitars and banjos that alternatively play the different parts of the composition. So the soundtrack functions as this collage between two musical genres, but also two different points in time too. So this artist is super interesting. He was new to me. He uses sound and sculpture to kind of pinpoint a variety of different topics, things that are also a lot more heavy, like social justice and like human rights. But I thought this example, also just a conception behind it, more kind of highlights these nuances that we're talking about today.
That's really interesting. I'm glad that we got to talk about this today. I think that, I don't know, just We know that this episode was maybe a little bit more disjointed than normal, but I thought it was kind of fun. I feel like I've just been in all of the whirlwind. I'm literally describing it as a whirlwind because I felt that way when I was trying to figure out this mystery, but it really just put me in a mood to kind of experience all of these visuals all over again, and it really does take you back to that place and time. So I really like this example that you brought up, Gianna, and I have been playing a little bit of putt-putt on Andrew's Switch. He bought the putt-putt game. I'm sure that a lot of you have played it as a computer game. It's the same company that does Freddy Fish. And just thinking about Mighty Kids Meals, watching The Princess Diaries, I want to watch The Parent Trap. It just has put me in this very encompassing mood of hearkening back to all of these sound visuals from my memory.
Oh my god, I died when you were playing Putt-Putt the other day. But the only computer game we had was Putt-Putt Goes to the Zoo, so it was very specific.
Putt-Putt Saves the Zoo. There was in the game that I'm playing now, it's Putt-Putt Travels Through Time, and there's a little, whenever I click a button, there are these little characters that come up and do a little promo from Putt-Putt Saves the Zoo, and it's the little theme song. Do you remember? Putt-Putt Saves the Zoo.
Yeah.
Putt-Putt Saves the Zoo. And so whenever I clicked on this and these little characters came up and sang that song, that's another thing where I was just like, oh my gosh, I remember that little theme whenever you open up the Putt-Putt computer game also. It's just like, when I think of Putt-Putt, I think of Putt-Putt Saves the Zoo. You know, just this little like chant. So I thought that this was just really fun, and it also definitely 1000% put me at peace, so thank you.
I feel totally at peace. This is like the greatest I felt in the height of my busy, productive weekend, so thank you for making us all feel so like calm in going back to the days of the 2000s, early 2000s.
Oh, I love it. Well, definitely email us at artpoptalk@gmail.com. Let us know what are some other songs or visuals that you have recalled throughout this episode that you've been thinking about. Anything you want to share with us, you can also DM us on Instagram. We'll definitely put up some little questions in our Instagram stories throughout the week. If you like this content and you want to hear more of it, please go to our Buy Me a Coffee account. You can donate a little coffee to us, and it'll help us keep the content moving along. And if you could rate us on Apple Podcasts, that would be really amazing. We would really appreciate it if you wouldn't mind heading over to do that. So, Gianna, anything else before we say goodbye?
I think we should probably let them go before we start talking about more things.
Yeah, because everyone's going to go and listen to the Y2K playlist.
Yeah, yeah. So. You're welcome, Spotify.
All right, everyone. We will talk to you on Tuesday. Bye.
Bye.
Art Pop Talk's executive producers are me, Bianca Martucci-Fink.
And me, Gianna Martucci-Fink.
Music and sounds are by Josh Turner, and photography is by Adrian Turner.
And our graphic designer is Sid Hammond.